Today's show is sponsored by Bob's Red Mill. With natural foods, they support organic, vegan, paleo, and gluten-free lifestyles. Learn more about their commitment to good food for all at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
My name is Hannah Forden. I'm the membership coordinator at Heritage Radio Network, but even before I joined the team, I loved listening to HRN during my subway commute. It made the time go quickly and left me feeling inspired for the day ahead. HRN listeners tune in from all over the world, but there are a few traits that we all have in common, no matter where we listen from: a curious palate, the fierceness to make a difference, and a hunger for lifelong learning about the culinary world. As you know, Heritage Radio Network is a listener-supported nonprofit. To deliver the most ambitious, entertaining, and of-the-moment stories in 2018, we need your help. We need to raise $150,000 by December 31st to accomplish these goals and to keep your favorite shows on the air. Together, we can make this HRN's most exciting, impactful, and delicious year yet. Become a member by donating today. Join us at heritageradionetwork.org/donate, and you'll immediately start enjoying benefits such as VIP invitations to HRN events, where you will mix and mingle with your favorite hosts. Memberships also make a perfect holiday gift for all the foodies in your life. This year, why not give the gift of food radio? You'll hear your generosity in action for the year to come. Help keep our lights on and our mics hot by pledging your support today at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Thanks for listening.
Hello, hello, hello. This is Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair, broadcasting live from Heritage Radio Network. My name's Amanda Dell. I am one of the co-directors of Food Book Fair. My co-captain, Kimberly Chow, is not with us today, but we have an amazing guest, so hopefully he'll be able to stand in and provide us with some good picks for what he's reading, because we know how good Kim is at that. In case you don't know, Food Book Fair is an annual food media festival held here in New York and hopefully coming to a city near you very soon. We also hold signings in the Green Market, weather permitting, and we are the proud hosts of Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair. We are joined in the studio today. We have some male energy here today, which we haven't had for a couple of episodes, so I'm just welcoming that and enjoying it for a moment. We are here with chef, author, and restaurateur Seamus Mullen. He has a brand new book called Real Food Heals, and he's here to talk to us about that, about what supplements he likes to take, how he's healing from what seems like pretty intense surgery, even though you can't see it over the radio waves. And who knows, maybe we'll get into talking about his love of Spanish food, which I share with him. So welcome to the show, Seamus.
Thanks for having me.
Anytime. We are very, very excited. And congratulations on your second book.
Yep. Thank you.
Yeah, know how much work
Oh, they're easy. You just sort
that.
Of spit them out. You come up with an idea and you hit a button and it comes out.
Somehow I don't think that's the case. So it must be very thrilling to see this.
Yeah, it's an amazing feeling when you first get the galley that you've been working on for, you know, oftentimes it's for years, and you finally have something that you can actually hold on to. It's an incredible feeling. And I think one of the things that just is so important to me about books is that it's a little piece of legacy. It's something that will always be around, and it's a moment in time. It's really, they're really amazing things. They're not going away, thank God.
Yeah. As one of our favorite Food Book Fair participants, JJ Good, once said.
Oh, I love JJ.
You love. Okay. So one of our favorite things that he ever said was he describes, like, in order to be a good cookbook, does it have the huggability factor? Mm-hmm. Meaning, do you want to crawl into bed with it? It's not just something to like prop up in your kitchen and you're like, be so serious about the recipe, but are you going to be able to sit on the couch with it and really enjoy it? And so I definitely took a deep dive into it.
Awesome.
And I like really liked it, and I'm definitely going to cook some stuff from there.
Good. We like dirty pages and banged up corners on books.
Yes. Well, this one's pretty new. When it just came out a couple weeks ago, right?
Yeah, about 2 months ago. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a pretty new.
Yeah, we're still newborns with it.
Yeah. So before we get into talking a little bit more about the book, maybe you can share with us some of the things that you've been reading or shows you've been watching that you've been enjoying, other podcasts.
Sure.
It's open. It doesn't have to be about food.
You know, as you can see, I'm sitting here with a sling on one arm and I had a sling on the other. So I just had surgery on both of my shoulders from a bike crash in Italy. And that means I've had a lot of time to... I've tried reading. I can do a little bit of reading, but I've been like, the pain was pretty bad for a while. So I was doing a lot of podcast listening and TV watching and whatnot. And, let's see, good things I've watched. I just saw a really good movie on Netflix that just came out called Mudbound, which I highly recommend.
Definitely have not heard of it.
Well, it came out in the theaters and on Netflix, I think only 2 days ago.
Oh, okay. Is it scary?
No, not at all. okay. Well, I mean, it is scary, but it's about kind of life in the South in the 1940s during World War II and race relations. And in many ways, it's really, really very moving and extremely at times difficult to watch. But it is also really relevant to the time we're living in right now. But a really, really beautiful film with kind of a glimmer of hope in it as well. So that's one thing I've seen. I have been trying to get into Stranger Things because everyone says that I should, but I haven't. Season one I watched, and season two I haven't been able to get into.
I feel you. I actually couldn't even finish the first season. It was just a little too sci-fi for me.
Uh-huh.
It's not my favorite. I think it's really well done, and one thing that I love about it is that it's original.
Mm-hmm.
So I was trying to get into it, but who knows? You know, it's Thanksgiving weekend.
Yeah. You never know. It's a good time
coming
for watching all sorts of stuff. And they've really made it just so this whole notion of binge watching, they've made it so easy for you that each episode starts just seconds after the last. So you're kind of like, I could watch one more.
Completely sucks you in.
It does suck you in. On the reading tip, let's see, what have I been reading that's... Well, cookbooks. I've just been thumbing through. My friend Diana Rogers has a book she just sent me, which I really love, called Homegrown Paleo.
Mm.
And she's one of the smartest people I know when it comes to nutrition. She's a farmer in Massachusetts, has a farm there, and knows a ton about sustainability and nutrition. What else? I'm good friends with Marco Canora, and I love his simple book Brodo, and I've been in part of my healing process, been drinking a ton of bone broth. So I've been going back to that and thumbing through his book Brodo, which came out last year. Let's see, other Katz's Art of Fermentation. I always go to that. That's a book that's pretty well thumbed in on my bookshelf.
So that's like on your nightstand.
Yeah. and actually right now on my nightstand, there's a book that my friend Darren Portnoy just gave me. And he was so sweet. He came over, took me out to lunch when I was just my first day out of bed, really, with the surgeries.
Yeah.
And we went out to lunch. And he brought two copies of this book called We Crossed a Bridge and It Trembled, Voices from Syria by Wendy Perlman.
Hmm.
And he's going to read it, and I'm going to read it. So we're going to do a little comparing of notes.
I think they call that a book club.
It's a book club built for two.
Yeah. Hey, it's still a club with two people. Right on.
And what else? I recently read Lindsay Addario has a book called My Life. Let's see. I know I can never remember these things. I always, it's What I Do, Life of a Photographer.
Hmm.
Life of Love and War, Lindsay Addario. She's a photojournalist. And she, it's sort of a memoir of her life as a photographer in war-torn areas over the past 15, 20 years and focusing mostly on women. And it's really a very, very moving and beautifully written book.
Amazing. I will have to check that out. Definitely send that over.
Yeah.
Speaking of women, I'll quickly talk about one thing I'm reading.
Okay.
Seamus, I don't know if you're familiar with The Wing. It's a women's co-working club. I'll call it a club.
Mm-hmm.
They have one location in Flatiron. They just opened one in Soho.
I just heard about it. Yeah, I tried to get in. They wouldn't let me in.
Yeah, it's pretty... They don't even let delivery men in there. So as much as you probably could have brought to the table, I think they're pretty strict on that. But, you know, seemed like overnight they actually started their own magazine.
Uh-huh.
And it's called No Man's Land, which uh-huh. I think is pretty clever.
That's very clever. Yep.
And I got an actual physical copy. And the other thing that totally was amazing to me about this content was that oftentimes on this podcast, we talk about New York Magazine Online,
mm-hmm.
which is, I think, putting out some of the best content in their verticals that is out there, whether it's Grub Street, whether mm-hmm. it's The Cut, whether it's Vulture talking about, you know, different television or movies. I just like, it's always up and I'm always constantly refreshing it.
Mm-hmm.
And also they have the Strategist, which is like their shopping,
yeah, yeah.
which is like,
that's great.
Kryptonite.
It's been around forever. The Strategist is great.
They have an online version now with click-throughs. That's very dangerous.
Oh, no. So you can actually buy all the groovy
stuff
that people
are wearing.
You can
buy it in like one click. It's pretty bad.
Oh, for that frictionless
yeah.
life.
So what The Wing actually did was The Cut is showing their content on New York Magazine's The Cut, which is the mm-hmm. fashion vertical. So if you don't get the magazine, you can always go to The Cut and see it. And I just think that that's pretty much genius to
that's
have
awesome.
Like a digital yeah. way of looking at it. And then also this physical magazine. Anyway, I highly recommend it. It's issue number one, No Man's Land.
No Man's Land.
The actress Hari Neff is on the cover. It's just Chef Angela DiMaggia from Mission, formerly of Mission Chinese, has a big feature, and there's Bra Ladies of New York. It's just really good. It's really it bridges that line between being serious but also fun.
Uh huh.
So.
Oh, that's great.
Don't no shame in your game to have a copy of it. So I've definitely been enjoying that.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Very cool.
So maybe Seamus, we can back it up a little bit and most of your recent, you know, work has really been about health and mm-hmm. how you've changed your lifestyle drastically based mm-hmm. on a diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis. And, you know, as a former restaurant person, I know kind of how toxic the business can be.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe walk us through, you know, you grew up on a farm, so... You know, I think you definitely had access to good food, and
I did, yeah.
growing up, it seems as if that was part of your life. So how did you get so far away from that?
Well, it's funny. You know, I grew up on a small farm in the 70s in Vermont and the 80s in Vermont, and my parents were really conscientious about food. We raised all our own produce and raised our own animals, slaughtered our own animals and all of that. And in many ways,
that must have been such an incredible childhood.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds really bucolic and idyllic. The reality is it was really hard.
Yeah.
You know, it was very, very tough. And as a kid, we didn't go to summer camp or anything like that. We worked on the farm. And I learned a lot, and I'm certainly grateful for a lot of what I learned. And in hindsight, looking back, my folks were kind of doing the best that they could with what the predominant knowledge at the time was. So, you know, what constituted health food and the notion of health food in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and for a long time was things like lots of carbs, lots of grains, lots of so-called healthy whole grains, and tofu and tempeh and a lot of things like that.
Mm.
And when I was a kid, I started having digestive issues very, very early on. So I would eat dinner and then immediately be bloated and feel terrible. And I didn't really realize until much later in life, until quite recently in the past few years, that a lot of the things that I was eating growing up, I was actually extremely sensitive to. So I ate a lot of carbohydrates. I ate a lot of gluten. I ate a lot of legumes. And these are all things that I immediately caused an inflammatory response in my body. So throughout my childhood, even though I was eating really good so-called whole foods, they were kind of, a lot of them were the wrong foods for me. And over time, as I, you know, I got very sick a lot as a kid. I got a lot of sinus infections and strep throat and things like that, and took a lot of antibiotics. And over time, that kind of just eroded my immune system. And in addition to just to eating foods that weren't really great for me, I was starting to erode my gut. So fast forward to when I started working as a professional cook in my early 20s, or even in my teens, and then early 20s and through my 30s. The lifestyle kind of shifted to where, as you know, it's a pretty hard lifestyle. It's a lot of staying out late and partying and not really taking care of yourself because you're too busy taking care of everyone else. And that's when my health really started to just go to pieces.
Yeah. What, and just describe that for us a little bit, and how it must, it sounds incredibly scary as well.
Well, I mean, I think the hardest part for me initially was not knowing what was happening in my body. Yeah. And just, I started to feel terrible and have really weird things. I mean, the sensation of feeling something that you've never felt before is always a scary feeling. If suddenly you have, you know, if you, your vision goes blurry for no reason or whatever it might be, or you, maybe you lose your balance and you've never had that sensation before. I'm sure everyone can relate to feeling something for the first time and how scary that can be. So I had things like that. But then I developed a tumor in the back of my neck that was very, you know, kind of out of the blue, and couldn't figure out what was causing that. And general just malaise and inflammation that then led to very acute attacks in different joints. And it was the sort of thing where I couldn't figure out any rhyme or reason to why these things were happening to me. Right. And the doctors that I was seeing at the time couldn't really either. And they looked at every element kind of in a vertical silo and in isolation, and weren't able to see that these were all things that were related. Until eventually I was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis,
right,
which is an autoimmune disease. And I went through the traditional allopathic treatment for that, which is biologic drugs. So to kind of suppress the immune system and reduce the production of inflammatory proteins called cytokines. But what it also does is it leaves you, among other things, very exposed to other sorts of infections. So I was treating the symptoms without actually treating the root cause of the illness.
Right. And so then as a chef, how did you make the connection to say, okay, clearly, you know, what quote unquote conventional medication route that I'm going, or their style of treatment is not working for me. How can I look into something else? Like how did you, I think people are very scared to maybe seek out alternative ways of healing themselves. How did you just start researching? Did someone suggest something to you? How did you get started?
Well, I started reading early on, and I always felt intuitively that there was a correlation between food and illness. And I sort of, in my hippy-dippy, you know, mentality thought, yeah, of course, you are what you eat and all of this. But I didn't really understand the nuts and bolts of it. And part of it was, it started with a curiosity and a desire to do anything to feel better. But even then, when I did things like, let's say, for instance, I ate a lot of turmeric and had a lot of dark leafy greens, I didn't feel better necessarily. And I think part of the problem is that I was still very much stuck in this idea of something that I call transactional health. Okay. It's the idea that you have a problem and you go to the doctor and the doctor gives you a solution. And that solution is then you've done your part. It's sort of like a one-to-one transaction. Have a headache, take this pill sort of thing,
right,
rather than say, look at all the things that led to you having a headache. And understanding that generally speaking, a state of health or a state of ill health, a state of good health or state of ill health is not the result of any single one thing, but rather it's the myriad buildup of thousands and thousands of micro decisions. And you can't make one change and expect that that's going to have some global improvement on your health. So I had to first recalibrate the way I thought about health, and then start to understand every single decision I make every day has an impact. And they don't all have to, I don't have to make every, you know, not everything I'm eating has to be loaded with turmeric, ginger, dark leafy greens and healthy fats, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I need to make sure that I am, the majority of the decisions I'm making are decisions that are contributing to good health.
Wow. Seems hard.
Yeah, it is. It was hard, but you know, I was in a position in which, the catalyst for me was I had a near death experience, and that was really the tipping point for me. And I realized if I don't make some serious significant changes, I'm not going to get out of this alive, or I'm not going to be around for very long.
Okay, well, we have to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll talk about those changes. We'll talk about the book, and hopefully share, some helpful strategies or ways to start improving your health from, you know, the foods that you eat when we come back.
All right.
So we'll take a short break. Remember, head over to heritageradionetwork.org. We are in the middle of our fundraising drive. So definitely hook us up with some cash so we can keep the airwaves hot.
Heritage. Cha-ching,
yeah. Cha-ching. Oh, sometimes David gives us a sound effect, but Seamus is here. So
yeah, that was the sound of people making donations.
Perfect. HeritageRadioNetwork.org, and we'll be back shortly.
If I come into a party hitting raps like this, all you superficial rappers will cease to exist. If I come into a party hitting raps like this, all you superficial rappers will cease to exist. If I come into a party hitting raps like this, all you superficial rappers will cease to exist. If I come into a party hitting raps like this, all you superficial rappers will cease to exist.
Bob Moore is the founder of Bob's Red Mill, top quality supplier of grains, flours, and general nutritional goodness from Oregon. He's talking to us about their signature millstones, a very specific way of making whole grain flour. So what's the secret, Bob?
Follow me to the mill room. Well, these are just like the millstones that the Romans used to grind their grains. In fact, these stones came from the same quarry near Paris, France, where the Romans got their stones. The company that makes our millstones pulls their quartz from the same quarry, and they make mills for us that are just wonderful.
Bob explains how the millstones grind much slower and at cooler temperatures than modern steel rollers. The process keeps the grains cool, preserving the flavor and nutrition.
Look at what they produce. I love how they keep things simple and just right. All the nutrition is there, just like nature intended.
After almost 40 years in the milling business, they're serving up over 400 organic, gluten-free, and whole grain foods right here from the mill in Oregon, sending them off to destinations around the world.
We think we can make a difference by sticking to the traditional way of stone milling. And so, that's what we're doing.
To learn more about Bob's Red Mill and their mission to bring good food for all, visit bobsredmill.com/podcast.
We are back. You are listening to Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair on Heritage Radio Network. We are joined in the studio by chef and author Seamus Mullen. He's talking us through his new book and also his health journey, which has been very informative already. And he shared a lot with us about kind of how he got here, and hopefully we'll get to talk about also where he's going. So we were getting into talking about the point where you found functional medicine, mm-hmm. in a way, and how did you really start? Were there resources that were really helpful to you? Like how did you then say, okay, tomorrow I'm going to make these changes. I'm going to eat this way. I'm going to, you know, not do these things. And was that gradual, or was that something that happened quickly?
Well, Dr. Google. No, I was,
Dr.
I was,
Google. Yeah, exactly. Okay.
No, I was really lucky that when, in that very low point, I did meet Dr. Frank Lipman, who, has become a very, very close friend and one of my mentors. And he, you know, he was incredibly supportive. My family was incredibly supportive. All of my friends and my team at the restaurants were really supportive. And in essence, you know, I couldn't have done it on my own. There's no way I could have done it on my own. You know, now in hindsight, looking back, I really had no idea what I was doing. But Frank really helped me create a program for me that worked and a plan that worked. And he also he was sort of like a coach on the sidelines telling me, listen, you are going to get better. You just have to do the work. You got to do the work. You got to stick at it and stay with it. And if you stay with it, you're going to see changes. And the volume of change you'll see will be dependent upon how much commitment you have to doing this. So that's what, you know, for me, that's what really kind of kept me going. And it was 6 months before I saw any improvement.
Wow.
And I was very sick. I was on a lot of drugs. I was very overweight. I was really inflamed. I had a hard time just getting out of bed in the morning. But I had in Frank somebody who was giving me the hope that things were going to change. And I think that was the most important moment for me was the moment that I decided I was no longer going to be sick. The moment I decided I stopped seeing myself as a sick person, that was the last day I was a sick person. And it was a long time before I started to see improvement, but I no longer had that mentality that I'm sick. My mentality was much more, there are things that I can do to take control of my health, and I'm going to do them. And once I started to see positive change, that's when it became incredibly empowering, because I realized I actually can be my own doctor.
Right.
And it's something that I've learned. I mean, even the situation I'm in right now.
Yeah, let's talk about that. For people who can't see through the magic of radio, Jameis has a pretty big sling on his now
on my right arm,
and he is slingless on his left arm, but had surgery 4 weeks ago.
Yeah, on my left arm. So I was wearing, up until yesterday, I was wearing slings on both of my arms, which makes for subway travel, you know, makes very challenging subway travel, amongst other things. But I was on a bike ride in Italy. I was riding across Italy about 5.5 weeks ago, and I crashed and pretty severely tore up both of my shoulders. So I tore all four of the tendons in the rotator cuff in both of my shoulders, and I also dislocated the AC joint and tore the labrum, which is the ligament in both of my shoulders. Really nasty things to do. So if anyone's had rotator cuff repair, they know how painful it is, and this is sort of as bad as it can get in rotator cuff repair. But I went to see my surgeon yesterday to get stitches out on my right side, and we went over my range of motion in my left. And he said that after 4 weeks, my range of motion is where most people are after 3 to 4 months.
Wow.
So I'm definitely bouncing back much more quickly, even though it's been really painful, the whole process. And I attribute that to largely to all the things that I've done. I haven't just, you know, oh, I'll take the anti-inflammatories and sit on the couch. Like I've been actively really working on things from diet to supplementation, doing acupuncture. I've been doing it once or twice a week. Doing obviously my range of motion exercises as well, but I think a lot of it has to do with the supplementation that I've been taking. That's really helped me bounce back from a healing standpoint much more quickly than I would otherwise. And that's something that I've learned, you know, as somebody who's come to be my own doctor in many ways. It's not that I intuitively know, okay, what do I need to do to recover from surgery? But I have a network of people that I can reach out to and say, okay, what do you think? What do you think? And so I talked to a doctor of Chinese medicine, and I talked to an osteopath, and I talked to a functional medicine doctor, and I talked to a nutritionist and physical therapist. And so I'm getting all of this different input and taking a little bit of each. And so I'm doing Chinese herbs, and I'm doing needles, and I'm doing collagen and bone broth, and I'm doing comfrey and arnica, and I'm doing CBD oil, and I'm doing like all of these things in silicon, all the different supplements that I'm taking. Right. And those are all things that I think are giving me a bit of an unfair advantage against this injury to recover.
Yeah. Ultra fascinating. I know you shared your daily supplements with Bon Appetit's Healthy-ish, and I saw on social media, it got reshared a lot.
Yeah.
Why do you think that this idea of taking supplements is still kind of, for lack of a better word, like poo-pooed by conventional doctors? And when you shared your supplement list, people were like, oh my gosh, I never knew about that. Mm-hmm. Like I never thought to take that. Or where do you get that? Or like, it still seems like this alternative world, as mainstream as it's become, is still shrouded in somewhat of secrecy.
Yeah. Well, I think part of it is that if you have really, really severe inflammation and you take prednisone or Celebrex, it goes away like that. But what it doesn't do is it doesn't address what's the cause of that inflammation. What are the things that built up to that inflammation? So in my case right now with the inflammation I have in my shoulder, when the pain was really bad and I wasn't sleeping, I took Celebrex, which is a really powerful anti-inflammatory. Now I'm not taking that long term, and I wouldn't take that long term, but it was enough to help me get to where I could sleep, and sleep is such an important aspect of recovery. And when you have double shoulder surgery, it's really hard to sleep. It's hard to find a comfortable position. But supplementation, on the other hand, is not like a silver bullet. So if you're dealing with chronic inflammation, and you expect that taking some curcumin, the extract from turmeric, is just going to wipe that out, it's not. But on a daily basis, as part of your regime, to have an approach that's about establishing an anti-inflammatory protocol over time, that's where you see results. So I think that the shift has to be, we all suffer from something that I call APS, Amazon Prime Syndrome, where we want what we want and we want it now. So you want to feel better tomorrow.
Right.
And Western medicine is very much geared towards that. Feel better tomorrow, whether it's from a surgical procedure, it's from, you know, cool sculpting and liposuction, or it's...
I did not know we were going to get into that.
No, but I mean, just like the idea of like, I want to change. I want a radical change. I want it right away.
Right.
Or a medication for, I have a headache. I take this.
Right.
And the practice of functional medicine, and also sort of the way that I've recalibrated my own thoughts about health, are much more about look at the whole, look at the body as a system, and be committed to the long term, because it isn't like a point of arriving. You don't get there. You're always in this process of getting there. You don't achieve good health. It's always a journey.
Okay. Interesting. So you still feel like you're going to feel even better.
Yeah, definitely.
Tomorrow or the next
Absolutely.
Coming year.
But there's peaks and valleys. I mean, there's going to be moments where you feel like crap.
Right.
And we're coming into flu season. And
tell me about it.
you're struggling with it. I was just, one of the podcasts I listen to a lot is, what's it called? How Stuff Works, or one of those guys, Chuck and the other dude, they have How Things Work, I think is what it's called.
Okay.
But they did a podcast on the flu and how the flu works. So I listened to that yesterday.
Yeah, don't be scared. I'm on the mend.
Okay, good. No, but it was really interesting because, you know, the flu is one of those things that it's just part of daily life and
right.
for all of us, and we have to be aware of it. And so just like anything else, yeah, I do think I'm going to feel better. But I also know that there's going to be times when I'm going to feel worse. And I just have to accept that. But in the general trend, my health is trending in a positive direction, and it has been for 6 years now. And I've been able to really affect that trend through the decisions I make every day. And not any one decision is more important than the other. And when it comes to the broad silos, I think of it as this three-legged stool, which I know you want to talk about, which is movement is a big part of it. So I think of it as nutrition, movement, and recovery. And that three-legged stool, no one silo is more important than the other.
I have another leg as a lifelong New Yorker, which is you should always touch the handles on the subway and the poles, because you really got to build up your immune system that way.
Yeah.
That's the way to go.
Yeah, that's good. Except for during flu season, then that's the way you get the flu.
not if your immune system is built up.
Yeah, it's true. Wash your hands, though. Make sure you wash your hands.
Definitely. So one, you know, a huge part of your healing process has been the food, and that's why you wrote your first book and then also your second book, Real Food Heals. Why did you feel like you wanted to write this second book? What do you hope that people take away from it? And what's just your greatest hope for this book?
I think one of the things that I really, really want to emphasize as much as possible is that eating for nutrition, eating for health, and eating for pleasure are not diametrically opposed ideas. I'm a chef. I'm a trained chef. My background is in making really delicious food. And I thoroughly, you know, I really do believe, firmly believe that delicious food and nutritious food go hand in hand. And I wanted to kind of show that through this book, that you can really eat very well for yourself and eat in a way that's really, really good for you emotionally and physically. And it's not that challenging. The book is really about trying to share my own journey with food. And the reality is that there isn't a one size fits all for everyone when it comes to what is the right diet, but there are some really broad strokes. And I tend to take my cues for nutrition more from evolutionary biology than I do from nutritionists or from, you know, men's health magazines or things like that. Like I'm much more in tune with, well, how did we evolve to eat as humans and how did Mother Nature, because Mother Nature knows a lot more than we do. And when we think we know more than nature, that's when we really tend to get in trouble. So trying to, as much as I can, mimic the way that we sort of evolved to eat, I think is a really important tool for understanding what's best for us. And then really just celebrating real ingredients.
Yeah. Well, the recipes are described as paleo-inspired. So talk to us about what that means to you and what that should mean to the reader.
Well, to me, the tenets of the paleo movement, there's much about that I really do think is right on point. When we really started to get off track was when we became a very, very carbohydrate-based dependent diet, when our diet became really based on carbohydrates. And before agriculture, we really ate very few carbohydrates and ate virtually no sugar. with the exception of some fructose in wild berries and fruit. But even that was in pretty extreme moderation. Mm-hmm. And so if you can, you know, for me, it's really about focusing on lots of vegetables and nutrient-dense vegetables, and then also very healthy saturated fats and protein in moderation, really treating meat and fish as an ingredient. And our ancestors, the way they ate was very much they ate meat when it was plentiful, mm-hmm. and when it wasn't, they didn't, you know, they ate as very little. They ate lots of tubers and vegetables and things they could forage for. And obviously in the 21st century, it's not realistic for us to lead our life like our ancestor did 10,000 years ago. But I think there's some lessons that we can learn from that. And when, you know, when we look at our Paleolithic ancestors, they had much, much lower rates of any of the modern diseases. In fact, most of the modern diseases that we know now didn't exist. And looking around the world to modern cultures that follow a diet that's much more in tune with their environment and their nature, you find very, very low instances of modern disease as well. And that obviously, this we could talk about this for hours, but it has a lot to do with the microbiome and their gut bacteria and their flora, which we're just starting to understand. So I think it's not realistic to think in the modern world that we're going to live like we did 10,000 years ago, but there's some really key takeaways from the ways that our ancestors lived that we can apply to our modern life.
Cool. Well, let's get into some of the nitty-gritty of the food, and I have two questions about that. Mm-hmm. One, I think that a huge barrier for people when they want to maybe adopt a little bit more of a holistic way of eating, eat out less or eat less processed food, I think one thing that holds them back is like, oh my God, am I going to have to like carry around my lunchbox all day? Mm-hmm. Like, how can people mentally, you know, get over this idea of feeling like if you want to eat a certain way, you have to make all of your food before or you can't mm-hmm. eat out? How have you kind of balanced that in your life?
Well, that, I mean, that's part of it, that you can't eat out and you have to make all your other food. And then the other part of it is that, oh my God, I have to spend all of my time thinking and preparing for food. And the reality is it does require a bit of a priority shift because you do, if you're going to cook for yourself, it does take some time.
Right.
And take some thought. But if you put that in perspective and you think about our, even a generation ago or two generations ago, somebody in the family spent half of her time thinking about food, realistically, you know, whether it was about preparation, procurement, or production of food. Our grandmothers, and it was almost always the women that were doing this, for the past several generations spent a good portion of their day thinking about food. And if you go back in time even further, you know, 75% of the time, if you go back in time like 10,000 years, everyone in the family spent 100% of our waking hours thinking about food. So food was like the only driver, really. And now we spend very, very little time realistically addressing food in our lives. And we spend less per capita than any other developed nation on of our disposable income on food in the United States. So we don't put a value on food from an economic standpoint, and we also don't put a value on food from an emotional standpoint, the way, or from a survival standpoint, the way that our previous generations have. So I think the first step is to say, okay, we have to do that. If you want to eat well, you've got to really consider your food. So that means when you're cooking for yourself, the time and effort has to go into production. And when you're going out to eat, time and effort has to go into thinking about the choice about where you're going to go out to eat. So maybe doing some research. And then when you're there, think about how you're going to order within the menu so that it does fall into the categories of healthy food for you.
Cool. You've made some changes at your restaurants, mm-hmm. Tortuglia and El Colmado, which mm-hmm. I love both of those. Has that been well received by your guests?
I think it's so subtle that, I mean, we've always been, the restaurants have always been seasonally based and in the whole farm to table kind of general umbrella of restaurants, even though they're Spanish restaurants. And we've always focused on, that's just kind of as a cook, how I grew up cooking seasonally
right.
and locally. I mean, those are the best ingredients are the ingredients that are harvested at peak ripeness. And so the switch to kind of reduce some of the carbohydrates and refined sugars and to emphasize more vegetables and become a little bit more vegetable-centric was not like a radical shift. It wasn't like one day we said, you know what, from now on, we're not serving paella.
Right.
for instance. You know, it was we've been conscientious about how we've made those changes. So it hasn't really been, you know, it hasn't been there. People enjoy it. People love the vegetable dishes that we do. And we focus a lot on, we use meats more as an ingredient within a vegetable dish. Right. So you might have a grilled vegetable dish where the meat plays out into a sauce or a vinaigrette that's in the dish. And in that sense, you really benefit from the protein and the saturated fats, but the vegetables are really at the core. So you're eating the majority of what you're eating is really, you know, dense, nutrient dense vegetables.
I love vegetables. So
we all,
yeah. Speaking of which, it's going to be Thanksgiving in a couple of days. And
oh goodness. That's right. Didn't it come early this year? Or am I wrong?
It felt a little early.
It feels
this
early
year.
To me.
I think cause there's a whole week after it maybe, but, it's just always sneaking up on you that yeah. Thanksgiving,
like that gobbler in the grass.
Yeah. So I know everyone's looking forward to spending time with family and friends and taking a break. It seems like it's been a pretty intense fall in New York from my
New
own
York,
perspective
everywhere.
And everywhere. Yes. Yes. True. Maybe let us know, like, what are a couple of recipes from Real Food Heals that should be on everyone's Thanksgiving table?
Ooh. Well, there's a roasted squash with pomegranate, which I think is really nice.
Pomegranate, like the
pomegranate seeds. Yeah.
Okay. I always forget what those, there's a specific word for those, right?
Oh yeah. They
like Arville or something like that.
Them? Oh yeah. There's a, I saw that recently. I had never heard it before. And yeah,
we'll call it a seed. That's what it is.
Right. So yes, they're a seed. What else? Well, you know, I'm not a big turkey fan, I'll be honest with
you. Yeah, it's not really that good.
No, although we've made turkey at Tertulia before for Thanksgiving. It's been extraordinary, but we do it gently, cook it in the grill, and it's you know, really lovely. But so I tend to do more chicken or lamb or roasts at Thanksgiving. There's a couple of lamb dishes that are really, really good in the book that I love. There's one that's lamb chops with maitake mushrooms. That could be a really nice thing to do. It's definitely the time for doing soup. You know, having a soup as a starter is always nice. I made a soup last night that took me
one-armed soup?
A one-armed, yeah. I've been cooking one-handed quite a bit. And it took me probably, I don't know, 35 minutes to make an absolutely delicious soup. It was celery root and parsnip with a little bit of bacon. And then I used, as a cream, I used the macadamia milk.
Oh, wow.
And then a little bit of sumac and cayenne pepper and some chicken stock and whatnot. But it's absolutely delicious. It's sitting in my fridge now. And that's what I typically tend to do is I make a lot of soups and batch stuff and then I have it. So I've got that. I might, use that as a first course on Thanksgiving.
Okay. So Seamus is bringing soup to Thanksgiving.
I'm bringing soup. One-arm soup.
Amazing. That sounds like a delicious recipe. And definitely we are bumping up against time with our show today on Heritage Radio. Again, make sure that you definitely show us some support by becoming a member. We are really in the midst of our fundraising drive, and we need to keep these mics hot so we can have guests like Seamus on. And I am doing something crazy. I will leave us with this for Thanksgiving that I want to get your opinion on before we end our show. So this is actually a family recipe that I have where I cook the turkey in a paper bag.
Uh-huh.
Have you seen this before?
No. So in like a shopping bag?
It's a little crazy. You have to get a completely letter or writing
ink-free
bag. And then it sounds like it's going to catch fire, but it never does. You have to completely oil down the bag.
Yep.
And then literally I put the turkey in there. I time it dependent on how big it is. And then maybe for the last half hour, I unleash the bag.
Uh-huh. That doesn't sound crazy to me at all. In fact, there's a dish that I do all the time. Very simple. I mean, I do fish and papillote where you're making, but instead of doing a parchment, whatchamacallit?
Paper or packaging.
A cartouche. I use just a brown paper bag, like a lunch bag, and oil it with olive oil, throw everything in, throw, you know, a pave of cod and some in the spring, maybe some asparagus and fiddlehead ferns, a douse of olive oil and some wine, roll it up and throw it in the oven at 400 degrees. And 6 to 8 minutes later, you have a perfectly roasted piece of cod.
Amazing. Let's call your editor. Do I see a paper bag cooking book in the works?
How to cook in a paper bag, yeah.
Well, you heard it here first. Paper bag cooking coming straight from Recommended Reading and Chef Seamus Mullen. Look for it. Coming out soon.
I see a video series with paper bags with eye holes cut out of them, like something out of the Cosby Show from the 70s.
That sounds creative. I'm into it. Again, thank you so much, Seamus, for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Congratulations on your book.
Thank you.
Have a hopefully delicious and restful Thanksgiving.
Thanks so much. You as well.
All right. Take care.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritage.org.